But here's the best way to think of this new version of Survivor.
Until it's bright out.
Survivor 41 is like the monster in a horror movie.
Oh, just another lonely night.
So either you devour the monster,
are you willing,
or the monster will devour you.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again talking some more Survivor 41, Episode 7 this week. The second half of our kind of merge, maybe not a merge, kind of air quotes merge saga that we have been embarking upon here. Dom, great to hear from you again. Welcome back. How are you feeling?
Feeling good. That may be the worst offense that this episode has caused, is throwing off the naming system for every podcast like this. But after last week's episode, I really had no motivation to come in here and talk about it, because what was there to talk about? We had no actual boot for the first time in maybe ever, God knows how long. I guess, was it the San Mendoza merge episode or something? Even then, we had someone leave, right? Like, it's so... Yeah, there was just nothing really there to talk about other than fuming about the twist. And this week we got to see how that twist actually played out. And then also, after all of the bullshit that came along with that, we had the makings of a very good episode, which is... So I want to talk about both of those things, but then also talk about how the all of the unnecessary nonsense kind of tried to smother what could have been an all-time great episode, and I think still was in many regards, but it's just frustrating that we have to keep qualifying it in those terms now.
Right. I think, as we will, I'm sure, get into in plenty more detail along the way, I am at least nervous and trying to retain whatever optimism I can that this will not be the case, but there are so many things about the new era of Survivor that I love and am looking forward to, hopefully continuing as more and more seasons go along and improving as more and more seasons go along. But I am still quite nervous about all of those positives potentially being, as you put it, and I think it's a good word, smothered by one or two very bad production decisions along the way. So, you know, we don't need to jump the gun here. I'm sure plenty more along those lines as we continue here. But yeah, to quickly return to one thing that you brought up, I believe the episodes where there have been zero eliminations, whether either vote-offs or quits or medevacs, are very few and far between over the course of Survivor history. The San Juan del Sur merge, we did at least have Julie, I believe her name was, end up quitting the game there, and it was very anticlimactic, but at least
not the future Mrs. Rocker, as it turned out. But let's be clear, there are very good reasons why that is such a rarity, and often when it happens, it's not by choice. It's not because it's a fun twist or a fun deviation from the norm to have no one leave in an episode of Survivor. The entire bedrock of the show is who's going to get voted out tonight. That's what Jeff always used to say in that opening voiceover, right, during the previously on. And so this is the exact kind of example for where there are certain things about the show that you have to take as sacrosanct, and deviating from those from the sake of it is not inherently exciting. And that's a message that more than ever we really need to drill into production's skulls, is that there's excitement because what you're doing is exciting. And then there's this kind of artificial excitement because, oh, wow, we've never done that before, without stopping to think about whether there are very good reasons institutionally why we've never done this before. And, you know, removing that precedent opens up a whole kettle of fish.
Right. And I think this whole hourglass thing with Erica, this cliffhanger that we kind of got set up with in last week's episode, is perhaps a good illustration of a direction I'm hoping the show does not continue taking, but it seems like kind of what they're into these days, which is, I don't think virtually anyone, casual fans or super fans alike, and I know I talked to plenty of casual fans. I had casual Anna in here to give the casual takes last week, and even she was saying, like, hang on, why wouldn't Erica smash the hourglass? Like, what conceivable reason could there even be for her to not to not do that?
Well, more of that in very short order, I think. But it is worth noting, we did finally get a previously on Survivor segment, but instead of actually introducing us to who any of the contestants are or reminding us of, okay, well, on this tribe, this is what went down in the pre-merge. And then over here, you have this faction versus this faction. And, oh, this person seems a little bit on the outs over here. So maybe they'll be inclined to flip or something. We got literally none of that. I don't think a single player was actually mentioned by name or any previous event was brought up other than this person has this advantage and this is how this works. Like the entire thing was just a montage of this is who has what advantage.
Right. And I think to return to Erica and the hourglass, the advantage in that case, and I suspect this will probably be the case for advantages this season and probably in future seasons, I don't think even the decisions around some of these advantages, and in this case, the hourglass with Erica, are necessarily even intended to be the thrilling decision points that the producers like have in mind when putting this stuff into the game in the first place. I think pretty clearly this hourglass thing was about as aggressively as possible implemented in such a way that the person in the Erica spot wouldn't even really have a decision. And it's not what's she going to do, it's how is this foregone conclusion on her end and the shakeup that ensues as a result of her obviously doing that going to affect the game. And that's big objection number one for me, of which there may be a couple more along the way here, but I think that is something that has been not non-existent in the history of Survivor, but if this is kind of going to be a thing going forward where the advantages more or less play themselves or the decisions make themselves, and it's really how is the rest of the group going to respond to the person obviously doing this thing that we have created this advantage for them to have no choice but to do going to affect things?
Yeah, as you say, effectively it's not Erica has this choice, which way will she go? It's Erica has just opened Pandora's box, and this is the twist that that has unleashed upon the game, which, if you want to set it up that way, I think it's kind of dishonest in one sense, and it's setting up a bunch of hoops that have to be jumped through for not much gain. But if you want to do it that way, fair enough. But then why have the entire first half of this pivotal merge episode rest on this cliffhanger about will Erica do this or won't she, when of course she will? There is no legitimate choice here. And you could have very easily set this up so that Erica does have a legitimate choice, where think about either if Erica is safe either way, but she gets to pick which tribe or which half of the tribe has to go and be vulnerable. And now whoever she selects to be in the firing line is going to have some real reasons to resent Erica. Or Erica is in the hot seat either way, and it's, well, bad news, you're going to be vulnerable at tribal council. Good news is you get to decide who else is vulnerable with you, and now that's a really high stakes choice where she gets to drag other people in there with her, and that has big implications. So there are lots of ways you could have cut it up where that would have been a serious choice that Erica has to make coming out of that first half, and you wouldn't know what she was going to do coming into part two. You could make an educated guess, but there's always a chance she could go the other way. With this way, there is no possible chance she was ever going to leave that hourglass unsmashed. She would be the Erica Reichenbach, right? Just like giving up immunity effectively if she hadn't. That would have gone down as one of the worst mistakes of all time, probably. So you know she's going to smash it. Everyone else out there knows she's going to smash it. And therefore, the moment she makes that choice, We see basically nothing more of Erica in this episode, because strategically she's not someone who people are like gravitating towards, and she's not a central part of what's going on. But then also no one resents her for the choice that she makes, because obviously you make that choice. Any other person in her position would make that choice too. So you set up this cliffhanger, which inherently is a flop because there's no tension to it. You remove any importance from that choice that Erica does make, in the beginning of this this second half here. And so you essentially waste what is usually the go-to most important, most exciting episode of the season to just waste time getting us to this point where now we finally get to reset things to semi-normal and have a decent episode of Survivor again. Where if we had just come in here last week and it's, all right, this is the twist, you're splitting into two teams, you're playing a challenge, one of these teams is immune, and then you're going to play for the personal immunity, you could question if that was a good idea for a twist, and we'll circle back to that in a little bit. But at least you would have had a conclusion to the episode, and it would have been probably a really fun episode if it had played out the same way. And I don't think you really would have had any complaints. And yet instead, I don't know who is satisfied with the way all of this was set up. And I guarantee you, in a few seasons' time, when we look back on this episode and this season, it won't be remembered for Erica decided to change the course of history, because no, she didn't really. It's, what was that amazing thing with Xander and Liana and the idol bluff, double bluff back and forth? That's what people remember it for. And that is at least semi-organic, or at least that's gameplay relating to the twist. It's not this incredibly contrived moment, which was always going to fall flat. And literally anybody watching the show or out there playing the show could have told you that. You don't have to have a decade of experience as the EP to predict how that one was going to play out.
Right, and I think one of the most important points that you flagged up there is no one's even mad at Erica for doing this, even though she's making six of them go from immune to vulnerable here, because of course they understand that while this is bad news for me, obviously I would have done the same thing in Erica's shoes, and she probably would have been pretty crazy not to end up doing that there.
You had Sydney in her exit interviews where it seemed like under basically no other circumstances could Sydney have gone home. And then on top of that, Erica and Sydney was the one rivalry on that tribe that we had set up in the course of the pre-mode. And even Sydney had no bad word to say about Erica or her role in making that choice. She almost seemed not just openly disdainful of the twist, but disdainful of the idea that anyone would not smash the hourglass in that spot. So even if the one person that you are meant to have this rivalry with is completely endorsing your choices here, it's like, well, okay, something has gone wrong somewhere in this process.
Yeah, these crazy twists are actually a roundabout way of bringing people together and sending a message of harmony, Dom. But we will surely down the line talk more about Liana and the knowledge is power advantage. We've seen idol nullifiers in the past, and there is certainly a precedent that has been set and is being reinforced in a major way this season about even some of the advantages you find in the game may not go as planned. There have been a couple cases of people actively finding like what are disadvantages along the way, and I think all of that is probably not great for the game for the most part, but at least is not aggressively misleading. The big thing that stood out to me, and well, I agree, I'm not going to think back to this point in this season years from now and immediately jump to, oh, Erica and that big decision with the hourglass, because again, I think that's pretty close to a no-brainer. But the number one takeaway I would have, even above the kind of shell game that was played with the idol and the knowledge is power and the back and forth with Xander and Liana et al., to me, the biggest thing that happened over these last couple of weeks, and I frankly don't know how this genie ever goes back into the bottle, barring some sort of explicit kind of announcement at the beginning of the game on some future season from Jeff that this sort of thing is not going to be happening at any point along the way here, and hopefully at any point in the future. But as we will see the players react to in some pretty negative ways as well, I do not know how, as producers of this show, they can ever recover from the players being extraordinarily skeptical of pretty much anything that pops up on pretty much any future season, now that we have seen our host slash moderator slash executive producer, showrunner, number one guy in the Survivor world, Jeff Probst, explicitly lying to the players in the game, like setting them up for, here's what we're doing, this is the way the challenge is going to go, this is what's at stake, and then to just completely pull the rug out from under them there and say, oh, just kidding, expect the unexpected, more or less. None of that was true. That, to me, is the biggest takeaway from these last couple of weeks, is knowing now, as far as I'm concerned, for the first time in Survivor history, that even the things you are hearing from the host may be complete bullshit. Again, I do not know how that genie ever goes back into the bottle, and that terrifies me.
Yeah, and this is a very real trade-off between short-term excitement, although in the case of this twist, I don't think anyone actually is excited about it, and that should have been enough to shut that whole thing down right then and there. But in theory, it's a trade-off between short-term excitement and the long-term damage that this causes to the structure and integrity of the game. And the classic example that we keep going back to for this is the Topaz reveal in EBCAN 1, right? Where, okay, in the short term, you have this amazing TV moment, and that, to this day, is still one of the greatest EBCAN episodes of all time. But through season 9 now, and season 10, and every future season, you are going to have players who know what they're doing be much more concerned about ever publicly vocalizing their thought process, or even in the diary room. You are going to get much less honesty, much less raw emotion, and so on and so forth, because everyone knows the precedent. Everyone knows that this is not a place where you can speak freely and know that that will remain private. And likewise here, think about how many of the foundational elements of the show rely on that certainty at the heart of it. So when Redemption Island was floated in the show for the first time, it's like, okay, well, yeah, you're going to have some of your favorite players, you're going to get some more scenes of them, and then if your Aussie gets voted out, or your Boston Rob, then you're going to get to see them on Redemption Island every week. At the same time, the trade-off you're making is you lose the finality of the vote out, and so every single tribal council now feels so much less eventful, because, you know, there's always this chance that that result could be overturned. And as it directly plays out here, why would anyone ever be like popping off after winning a challenge ever again? You know, some of those great moments where it's 7 against 1 and that one person pulls out the clutch win in the challenge, and they're hooting and hollering, and the other 7 are looking around at each other thinking, well, what the fuck do we do now? You're never gonna see that height of emotion again, because why would you? Because you don't know if you're safe. You know, you don't know if you're gonna show up to tribal and one of the 7 is going to read the immunity necklace nullifier advantage. And it's like, when you can't take that for granted, then you don't get to see the stuff that make the show so compelling. And this is taking that principle, which is very dangerous, even in small doses, and extending it to this absurd extreme where now it's just like this funhouse circus ride, basically. And so you see Danny, like, not even trying to hide how frustrated he is about it, and rightly so. And I think in his case, some of it may be that same pro athlete mentality that led him to be resistant to throwing the challenge initially, because that's just not how he's wired. But even the others, like, you see this debate between Danny and Deshaun about the correct response to the situation. But even Deshaun, who is in theory the voice on the other side, he goes on to say later in classic Deshaun style that, you know, I wish my social abilities would factor into this game a little bit more. And it's like, yeah, I wish they would factor in a lot more. I think you are understanding it, if anything, right?
We see Danny and Deshaun, I think, kind of be the mouthpieces for the two different ways that the players are interpreting this kind of news about this being the new normal, I guess, for Survivor kind of going forward, and Deshaun, who for my money handled it better than pretty much anyone else, and I cannot believe that he was able to do such a good job, even he at Tribal Council, while being very respectful of Jeff, was still saying, this is not what I expected, and I wish that my social relationships had more of an impact. That's all, Jeff. That's all I'm trying to say. Like, even Deshaun was visibly frustrated by this at a certain point.
Yeah, and in that sense, I think Sydney was actually the perfect boot for this week, not just because she would have been safe in basically any other circumstances, as far as I can tell, and it took this weird confluence of twists and then all of this twists breaking in exactly this way for her to go, but also because you know she's someone who not only is unfiltered, but like makes a big point. Her whole shtick is hamming it up as much as possible. And so, yeah, she's in all of her exit press, she's calling this out as this bullshit twist. And she has this great quote in one of them saying, the only way they could have gotten me out was with like 15 advantages and a twist. That's the stupidest shit ever. Sydney told US exclusively, but maybe not so exclusively. so, yeah. That's sick. I wasn't outwitted, outlasted, outplayed. I was out fucking lucked. And she's not wrong, but when everything else that she says is so like dialed up to an 11, it's easy to write it off. But here it's almost like, yeah, that's the normal reaction to have. And anyone else who was voted out in this episode, it would be quite entitled to have that exact same reaction.
Right. And to be clear, I have been, or at least tried to be, a huge advocate over the years regarding the sheer amount of luck that goes into Survivor. This is, on that front, nothing even slightly new. Like, I think starting Tribe Draw alone plays a massive role in every single season that has ever been played. And obviously, as idols and more advantages come into the mix, that just gets more and more extreme. And I am so happy to grant that that is absolutely a part of the game Survivor. I think the distinction, though, and this is something that we see discussed between Danny and someone else, I think it may be Shan, who is kind of putting up a couple counterpoints to him when they're just back from the challenge, and he's letting the tribe know how he feels about the latest twist in the game. And he says, this is really tough for me to process. And I think it's Shan, but it may be someone else. Sorry if I'm miscrediting here. Someone says, but Danny, that's been the thing every single day. We've had to deal with this the whole time. And Danny says, and I think he's right, no, it hasn't. We drew rocks. We competed. There was a winner and a loser, and the prize was a feast and immunity. And I think, again, to return to the idea of just Jeff pulling such an aggressive and kind of gleeful bait and switch on the players on what is going on, what is at stake. I think in Danny's mind, and I don't think he would be wrong for feeling this way, this would be like, to put it in professional football terms, like, we went out there and we beat this other team 42-0. And then after the game was over, you revealed to us, oh, actually, this one random time we decided that touchdowns are worth negative points. So actually, you lose, you get nothing. Good day, sir. I don't think this is consistent with the many, many other forms of luck and twists that we have seen. And there are a million of them over the history of Survivor. I think this is a completely separate thing. And I think Danny is dead right, and I'm sure I would be feeling very similarly to the way that, at least on the TV episodes, it seems like Danny was feeling out there. And I'm guessing, by the way, Danny was probably not alone. It is really Danny and in her exit press, and to some extent on the show, Sydney, who are kind of the mouthpieces of the "this is complete bullshit" kind of movement among the players within the game. But I have to imagine that many, many others, if not most others, were feeling similarly and saying similar things, and it just did not make the final cut for one reason or another.
Yeah, I've seen some understandably cynical takes that they're trying to set Danny up as like the sore loser of all of this, and that he's someone who he doesn't accept the direction that the game is taking, and so the game is going to pass him by. And if only he had silenced those criticisms and played the game as it is rather than the game that he wants it to be, then he might have done better, which maybe long term that's what they're setting up. I didn't get the sense that that's what they were doing here. I think they were just showing that genuine disagreement between Danny and Deshaun, but I think it goes beyond that. I think it's not just Danny and Deshaun, it's Danny and probably a lot of people who for now are taking Deshaun's approach to the situation and just not complaining about it out loud, but like have some serious questions internally that they're asking themselves, versus, you know, that's the true distinction that needs to be drawn here, I think.
Right. And to me, the only other thing that I can think of that is in this same kind of tier, and we spent a great deal of time talking about this in these terms when it was happening in real time, is on season 35, when the Chrissy and Devin and Ryan alliance finally had Ben Driebergen vulnerable after his string of miraculous idol finds and Ben bombs, etc. And at long last, we are able to get rid of him at Final Four, and this miracle run is at last coming to an end here. And the producers, as far as I will ever be concerned, essentially said, we are taking this away from you. Ben's story is just too good. Here is the magic fire challenge falling out of thin air at Final Four that we have been sitting on for a little while and just waiting for this exact kind of situation to implement, to give Ben one last lifeline there. And Chrissy, when she wins that Final Four immunity, very conspicuously it goes from daytime where she finds out the news to a like sun is setting borderline nighttime version of a confessional of her talking about it, I would imagine, because it took her quite a while to be able to get those words out in a way that was suitable for air. And I really I think that's exactly what happened, frankly. And by the way, I am not at all saying that they came up with the Final Four fire-making twist on the spot there. I think they had it ready to go for whenever a Ben Driebergen type needed it. And that happened to be the case there. And I do not believe that Danny or Sydney or Chrissy before them or any future players who are overtly kind of sour about these sorts of twists being complete blindsides when they are implemented and just so grossly against any idea of what the spirit of the game was that they could have conceivably had up until that point. Those people are not being bad sports, as far as I will ever be concerned. It is the producers who are being bad sports.
Back when Harry Potter comparisons were more in vogue, people always used to joke about how badly designed Quidditch was as a game, where it's just like hours of random pointless shit, and then whoever catches the thing and gets 150 points was just guaranteed to win on the spot. I think in this context, the actual better comparison there would be when they're giving out the house cup at the end of every book, and it's, as it stands right now, you know, one house has 400 points and this house has 200 points, but I just feel like giving you 150 points and you 200 points, and oh look, we have a new winner with 750 points. What an amazing twist. And it's like, well, no, that's just what you decided needed to happen. There's no kind of organic outcome there. So that honestly is what it kind of feels like when you have a twist of this magnitude being thrust into the game. And Jeff, like, I would almost want to be a fly on the wall, not just in the production room, but also just in as the homunculus in Jeff's brain during this time as all of this is playing out, thinking like, well, how does this compare to his vision of, like, was he expecting this unanimous great reception among the players and then, oh, wow, Jeff, you've done it again. You've really excelled yourself this time. Or does he adopt that stance of, well, yeah, it's controversial, and that's good. That's how you know that people are excited. And if you're bored, that's much worse than if you don't have a strong opinion either way. You know, that's the worst possible outcome, right? I could see him breaking either way on that.
That is one theory I have heard floating around and have wondered about myself. And I think this is probably a bit too far, even for me, as shocking as that may be. I think it is largely a function of even we are not adequately aware of how little credit Jeff gives the audience and how much of a focus is at this point going into making sure specifically little kids are happy with the result at the end of the episode, and whatever happens to get us to that point is mostly going to be water under the bridge as long as the result isn't devastating. And probably more on that a little bit later there, but I have certainly heard it floated, and I think it's at least not impossible in this era of just modern media that we are in. There is a very large and very clear percentage of just the landscape that gets by on hate clicks and incendiary headlines and cringe kind of content that is not intended to be legitimately interesting. It's intended to get a bunch of page views because people are really upset about it. And I think it's at least conceivable that while I would personally be leaning more towards the idea that Jeff and company really did think this would be something that would be in like on its own merits kind of interesting to throw into the game while acknowledging that it's probably not very fair, at the very least, a part of me at least does wonder, are they deliberately just trying to irritate people because that will generate buzz?
That would not surprise me either. And frankly, that's the most terrifying theory of all of this, because at that point, there really is no way back. There's no way that Jeff can convince himself that anything needs to change, because either everyone loves it, and I don't think everyone loves it, but if from your vantage point, everyone loves it, great. If everyone hates it, well, they're talking about the show, so that's great. And if they don't seem to be talking about the show by whatever metric you're using, well, you just come up with a new twist to get them talking. And so all of those three outcomes kind of lead you to the same position, ultimately.
Right. And the good news, I think, is I do not know virtually anyone, and I'm happy to grant that these people exist, but every super fan I've heard from and the numerous casual fans that I have heard from over the last week or two all absolutely hated this hourglass immunity reversal kind of twist. And for quite a while now, I am happy to grant that the people in the camp that I am about to describe are leading much happier and much more fulfilling lives than I probably am. And I am deeply jealous of them in at least this kind of respect. But one thing that like, I wish I would literally pay money to be able to believe this myself. But as things stand for me in reality, like it pains me when I hear people say this is like any survivor is better than no survivor kind of crowd. I think as an audience, from merely like a game theory optimal perspective, the absolute worst message we could possibly send to the producers of this show is I don't care what you put in front of me, as long as you call it Survivor, I'm going to be excited. I'm going to be tuning in. I'm going to be live tweeting and giving you free publicity for this show. The best thing we could possibly do is hold them accountable for this sort of thing. And again, I am so eager to grant that in this context and in virtually all contexts of life, that is the much more pleasant and enjoyable kind of attitude to have. But from the perspective of if we want this show to go back to being as good as it can be, instead of going completely off the deep end, the absolute worst message we could possibly send is, I'll be upset with you from time to time, but it doesn't matter. There's nothing you could do to get me to stop watching this show. And I want to say, I know we've probably been fairly critical over the first 30 minutes or so of this podcast. And the reason for that, as usual, is obviously I am a person who fell in love with Survivor. And I don't even think that's being hyperbolic. Like, this show has been a major part of my life for over 20 years at this point. I have put a ton of time and energy into getting the most out of Survivor being on TV that I possibly can. And there are, I want to be clear, so many things about this new era that if we were to set aside these insane, game-breaking, franchise-altering deviations, would leave me perhaps more optimistic than ever about what this show could be going forward. I continue to believe that this is one of the best casts of all time, and I really am a fan of a lot of the ways that the editing and kind of general presentation of the show has improved pretty drastically over the last few seasons as well. And I don't want that to be lost in the kind of pessimism that we are putting out there this particular week. Like, I firmly believe that it would be very easy to recover from this sort of thing if Jeff got the message that this is the exact opposite of what super fans and casual fans want out of a season of Survivor. It just is growing increasingly nerve-wracking for me that this quote, I can't believe, yet again, I'm going back to something we heard from Jeff in the premiere that I've mentioned on pretty much every single podcast to this point that I really liked hearing him say, which was in his opening monologue before we even saw anyone from the cast come out. As he's just talking directly to the camera, he's saying, look, this is a new era. We're going to try a bunch of stuff. What do you want from me? We're going to see what works and what doesn't, and we'll take it from there. That is exactly what I wanted to hear out of Jeff, and I'm hopeful that he maintains at least some of that same perspective at this point. But I, again, just grow increasingly nervous about, he seems to be kind of transitioning on the show and in interviews that he's giving to Dalton Ross and whomever else, as this is all going on, and he's seeing the real-time reactions from the audience. He's saying on the show, you can tweet at me at Jeff Probst, not going to read it anyway. And he's, I wish I had the quote in front of me, but I don't. But he's essentially saying in some sort of weekly interview that he did, I'm saying it's Dalton Ross. It may have been someone else. I'm sorry if that is the case. He is, as far as I can tell, pretty proudly saying, if you don't like it, I don't care. And that is horrifying to me about the way I have to, at this moment, project the future of this franchise to look versus how good I know it could look if the producers were more receptive.
I do think that any celebrity or franchise, once they become entrenched to a certain degree and they have a certain level of success, it becomes basically impossible for them to get useful feedback about themselves or their product, because you could always find a procession of people who either genuinely like whatever direction your content has taken or are willing to say all the right things in the hope of, you know, getting that attention, getting those opportunities, whatever. And so it is so hard at that point to actually detach yourself from the situation and see how it really is being received by the audience at large, by your target audience, whatever. And I think both Jeff and Survivor are in that spot right now, where even if Jeff woke up one day and was more open than he honestly seems to be to getting that kind of feedback, I don't know where he would get it or how easy it would be for him to take it on board, because he is kind of gone over to that other plane now, where there's no kind of bare bones contact with the fan base at large, if that makes sense.
I mean, I genuinely think the answer is Tyler Perry and Jimmy Fallon. And this has been something we've been talking about for years at this point. But I truly think if Tyler Perry texted him, that would have way more of an impact on his opinion about how the show needs to look going forward than however many millions of fans collectively tweet at him or talk to him on the street or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, we say all of this out of a desire for this to be better. Like when I don't have the anywhere near this level of emotional attachment to Big Brother, let's say. And so I do what I always do. I tune in for the first episode of Big Brother. And if I don't like what I see, whether it's from the cast or from the twist of the season, I just don't watch it. And I don't really think about it. And I mute the hashtag on Twitter and I move on with my life. And I don't care. Whereas with Survivor, I really want to have this level of emotional investment in every season. And I want it to be something that I can sincerely encourage other people to watch at the same time. And so when I feel like I don't have that or I can't do that, it affects me in a way that it really doesn't otherwise. And as you said, I think specifically this group that we have at the Merge here, one of the best Merge casts that we've had ever, frankly. And this episode, I think, will go down as one of the best in recent memory, even despite all of the bullshit that was laden on top of it. Just that final outcome and the way we got to see all of that frantic scrambling at the end, loved all of it. And so there's clearly the potential for greatness on this season, and I don't want that to be stifled and for then this to compound on itself because Jeff is taking the wrong lessons away and he thinks, oh, well, clearly it was this cast that didn't sit well with the audience, or it was something else, as opposed to a direct consequence of the decisions that he and others are making there.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm hoping, and for at least the foreseeable future, I'm confident I will be able to convince myself that there is still reason to believe that things can change. And I am praying that this kind of goes the way of what I would consider like the MACTOR, the model / actor era of Survivor, that in my mind, I think was kind of like the early 20s or so, and probably a little bit beyond that, but where they were putting out so many people who either weren't really familiar with the game or didn't really care about winning the game, and over time became clear on the fact that that is not the kind of person we want to have out here. And now, thankfully, most of the cast on most of these seasons are big fans of the show who know what they're doing, want to play hard, care deeply about winning and getting the most out of the experience that they can. There have been other points in the history of Survivor where things have seemed like the producers just over and over refuse to learn what I would have considered a pretty straightforward lesson right away, but they do eventually get there. And I am, again, holding out hope that that can be the case with these kind of franchise altering deviations from what is conventional Survivor and frankly what is good Survivor as far as I would be concerned, and it seems like as far as the general Survivor watching population would be concerned. So it is not at all the situation for me where I'm saying if this happens again next week I'm just done with the show forever and you should be too. That is far, far from the message I am trying to communicate here. And if I were trying to communicate that here, I think we'd be in for a bad time. Without getting into specifics, rumor has it that there may be some other kind of
yes. So
this is
a little dicey, but
we may have more coming along these lines out of down the line here. And to be clear, I am, as always, fully unspoiled on what that is going to mean for anyone's placement within the game. But there have been rumors circulating that I'm sure the many people listening to us know what we're talking about at least one other twist that may be coming down the line.
Let's stop this pity party for now, you know, 45
sure.
minutes in.
Yeah.
Let's move on to something which I think is actually a little more ambiguous in terms of how well it did work or could work, because this idea of splitting the tribe into two camps where you can only vote for someone from whichever half of this tribe doesn't win immunity this round. I was skeptical of the need to do this. Last week, I thought, if you're going to do this, why not save it for like the round of 11 or some episode later on where you don't get the natural merge bump that you get for that episode, and you need some new hook to keep things going once it looks like those battle lines have been drawn at the merge vote. But thinking about this more, I think so much of what we saw that we did like about this episode, and which was exciting at the end, only really could have happened under this setup. I think if you came in here and it was a normal merge vote, one person's going to win immunity, good job, Ricard, you're safe, and the other 10, 11 of you are vulnerable, I think we might just get this fairly formulaic split vote with a massive majority, and it's some number of votes on Evie and some number of votes on Xander, and maybe Liana tries to use the steal an advantage, and we see how that plays out anyway, but then the whole dynamic of that is different, because if Xander is vulnerable himself, then can he really justify giving the idol away to Evie or Tiffany in advance? So we saw this really interesting outcome, but I think it was an unique outcome that only could have happened under this scenario. And I think if you compare it to what is likely to happen under just a normal vote out, I actually like what we got a lot better. So maybe I was wrong on that. Maybe this was a smart idea to fire off here in this exact window.
I have come around on this idea, and I would say upon initially finding out that this is what is going to happen, I think I had some sort of traumatic kind of reaction to hearing that half of the group is going to be immune because of this most recent season of Survivor AU, where Australian Survivor, excuse me, where I watched the first half or so of the premiere episode, and someone stumbled upon, I think it was literally day one, an advantage at their camp that said, the next time you go to tribal council, you individually get to pick five other people to be immune with you. And that is a much different thing than what we ended up getting here. And honestly, were it not for the all-time kind of rug pull on which half was going to be vulnerable and which half was going to be immune, I'm totally down with this. I think this is a good illustration of a fresh and exciting way that we can mix up the game in a fair way, again, setting aside the rug pulling that Probst ended up doing there. And beyond that, I like the shot in the dark. I think that's a fun thing that people know about in advance, and it kind of complicates the game, makes it more interesting, adds some suspense to the episodes. I'm telling you, when Sydney said, like, raised her hand and said, Jeff, I have something to play, when it was time to play your advantages, was one of the few parts this week where I felt there was some sort of legitimate kind of suspense. And I'm totally open to this sort of thing continuing to be a part of the game. I was very skeptical at first, but I think you're totally right that it adds an interesting and fresh kind of dynamic when done in a fair way, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. I am less sure about the shot in the dark. So fast forwarding to the end of this episode, we see Sydney be the first one, I believe, to actually use her shot in the dark. And even that, she was resistant to the idea, as she explained in her exit press, where she thought that idea was fairly harebrained as well. But I don't want to use it, but hey, I'm desperate times, desperate measures. How likely am I to need my one vote? Pretty likely, as it turns out in this one case, but I don't think she could or should have seen that coming. So she uses it, and she pulls this funny face when she turns over the scroll and it's not safe. And okay, that's kind of fun, but is this going to be more than that much of the time? Because if the odds are such that it is either game-breaking, where there is a good chance that someone now becomes safe and everything gets flipped on his head, and we would be in here complaining about that, let me tell you. Or someone isn't safe, and they never had that great odds of being safe, and so that kind of a turn around the score with a funny face is the best you can hope for from that twist. And in return, you have this whole new layer of complexity to the episode for seemingly very little gain.
So I think this, for many different reasons, was kind of an outlier case as far as how meaningful someone taking their shot in the dark is going to be in general. And I definitely remember when we were in here in one of the early weeks, just kind of talking about this new twist, the shot in the dark, and how it might affect things, having a conversation about 1 in 6, at least as far as I was concerned, actually being much worse odds than I would have guessed the producers would give to someone if they are going to have this sort of twist in place. And honestly, I think I would be fine with it if it was 1 in 5, 1 in 4, somewhere in there. And I would not be even remotely surprised if the shot in the dark meant that the person who knew they were vulnerable that night got a 50-50 chance at being immune by pulling the right scroll. I wouldn't be down with a 50-50 chance, but I would not be shocked in the slightest if the producers ended up making the odds even that good. And just as a new thing to throw into the game, and furthermore, as a storytelling device, I think the shot in the dark goes a long way in building some sort of suspense where it may not otherwise exist. So I think the shot in the dark is something that I am totally fine with seeing remain a part of Survivor going forward, and would not be remotely surprised if, one, the odds on future seasons are altered to make it more likely that the person who goes for it winds up safe. And that I'm personally, I think, fine with it as long as it's not super extreme. And I honestly feel like, Dom, I don't think it would be the craziest thing in the world to change the rule so that when you play your shot in the dark, you still get to vote. I don't think I would have much of a problem with that.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that, honestly. So once that division and then the switcheroo is all locked in, we now do have this fight for individual immunity. Some premium feat content here for the small segment of perverts in the audience who are really into that sort of thing.
We don't kink shame here, Dom. It's not my thing, but I'm certainly not here to tell anyone that they're wrong for feeling that way.
Look, all I'm saying is this immunity challenge is a bit weird for 99% of the audience and the best challenge of all time for a solid 1% of the audience. So love that for them, I suppose. Ricard wins, potentially a very clutch win for Ricard, because I was thinking as just looking down the list of who was in which half of the tribe here, Ricard stands out as someone who is both outside that Yasa 3, so he can't even rely on being in the mix for the idol for the Evie, Xander, Tiffany group. And also he's outside this big, like a Luvu plus majority, where he's not in Luvu. He's not in the Black Alliance, which is like the inner core of the onion within the Luvus. And the only link that he has to any other player in the game is Shan, who is very influential, but has enough options that she doesn't necessarily need Ricard. And based on their recent interactions, I don't know if she wants Ricard there either, especially as he is someone who maybe could blow up her game. He knows what her game is and could expose that and be someone who could conceivably turn other people against her if it came down to that, if he wanted to flip. So if Ricard ended up being a accidental or maybe intentional casualty of this vote, I don't think that would be the worst thing in the world for Shan. So I think he would have reasons to be very scared if his name was still available. Luckily for him, he's able to pull this out, and he's going to be safe. And not much more from Ricard in this episode, although we see a brief scene of him talking with Erica before they go to tribal, and that's also the one other scene we get from Erica in the episode, basically. And I don't know if that was meant to be part of just this scene setting montage of people scrambling and look how chaotic this vote is going to be, or if this is just planting the seed of, oh, hey, maybe these two, who both of whom kind of are on the outs and don't really have many allies, maybe they could team up and do some work before very long. And then also at Tribal Council, when we had these two huddles, you know, the small huddle over here with the Yassas and then the gigantic huddle of everyone else over there, there's this one moment where Ricard looks away from his huddle towards the other one and gives this massive shit-eating grin and then turns back towards his own huddle again. So really enjoyed that, but hoping to see some big things from Ricard before too long.
I'm very happy that Ricard won this immunity challenge, because from what I've heard, and obviously exit interviews are not necessarily canon here, I do buy that Ricard conceivably could have been in some trouble at this vote, just given the pool of players who would have been vulnerable and how little I think most others within the game felt like they owed Ricard or would lose for themselves if Ricard were the one to go home. It is very often the case that the merge vote is someone people are able to just get enough folks around them who are willing to say, okay, I'd be fine with seeing this person go. Let's just make sure it's not me and I'm on the right side of the vote here. So I am very happy that Ricard won this immunity challenge and gets to stay in the game, because presumably we are not going to keep redrawing new teams and half the group is going to be vulnerable, etc., down the line. I'm anticipating, at least for the most part, that these are going to be individual, personal immunity challenges going forward, and everyone else, setting aside advantages and so forth, is going to be vulnerable there. And now that Ricard has survived this first vote, I certainly don't think he's in the best spot in the game, but he might, for my money, be in the most interesting spot in the game, because we've certainly seen him and Shan work well together, but have plenty of kind of back and forth that may not be incorrectly described as rocky or tumultuous, to say the least. I don't think they are a locked-in duo, and I don't think either of them is under the presumption that their partner in that original green team, who is still around at the merge, is feeling that way either. And at the same time, I don't think Ricard owes pretty much anything to anyone as things stand right now. Obviously, alliances are forming, and it's not great to not be included in the ones that are looking more solid at the moment. But Ricard is someone, as far as I'm concerned, who is a very clearly at least capable, if not far beyond capable, player of Survivor. Possible hot take alert here, I don't know, but
oh god,
for my money, I would say Ricard played the pre-merge at that green tribe better than Shan did. I know that Shan was often the one in the driver's seat, but I have, as I'm sure we'll get to a little later, I feel like we've seen multiple instances of Shan playing pretty sloppily these last several weeks in particular. And I feel like while Ricard, as far as I can tell, doesn't have any kind of like locked in group or necessarily even anyone who feels particularly great about him at this point, I feel like we're still early enough that that is by no means the end of the world. And if, again, I am not suggesting that Ricard is in the best spot in the game or even an actively good spot within the game, but I do think he is in perhaps the most interesting spot in the game. And I, for one, am going to be very curious to see what becomes of Ricard here, because I feel like pretty much anything is on the table for him as far as who he ends up working with or when he ends up being eliminated. I feel like Ricard and Erica probably to a lesser extent is kind of the people who don't owe pretty much anything to anyone are going to be two of the folks that I am very interested in tracking along the way here for as long as they're around.
Yeah, and the two of them together as a unit, they could be this like block in the middle who's going back and forth, and just their votes are up for sale to the highest bidder here. let's talk about Shan, because this is the first episode, really, where we didn't need to talk about Shan. It was a remarkably quiet episode for someone who was, certainly, I know in editing terms, you and many others have been saying, by far the front runner in the season. She was easily the most visible character in the pre-merge, the most important player, it seemed, and not just because her tribe was going to tribal council every single time, but also forming this rock-solid cross-tribal bond with Diana, which, and now, like, they seem to be each other's number ones. So in terms of just sheer impact on the season, it seemed like Shan was absolutely up there. You had some classic Collinstone hyperbole from non-Collinstone sources saying that Shan was playing, you know, the best pre-merge game of all time or whatever. And then this episode, she wasn't really there.
Yes. And incidentally, hugely missed opportunity, as far as I'm concerned, to not have the diabolical Shan kind of theme music playing in the background as Jeff was explaining the way that this twist works to the rest of the guy. I feel like that would have been a very nice touch there. But yeah, I thought Shan would be one of the focal points of how things would play out here at the merge. And we saw staggeringly, for my money, little of her compared to just my expectations for that, because it definitely does seem like, despite some, for again, this is just my personal take, and I am always eager to acknowledge that this is a heavily edited TV show and we're not getting the full story and so forth. I have gotten a couple of times along the way some kind of bad vibes is the wrong way of putting it, but I've had some serious eyebrows raised at some of the decisions and conversations that Shan has had, particularly like blowing up Liana's spot about having the advantage when Tiffany was right there, and some of the ways that she handled particularly that relationship with Ricard, as the two of them were, it seemed like, pretty clearly about to be the last two people left on the green team. I expected far more from Shan in this merge episode, and that to me was one of the bigger surprises of the week. We still got some Shan and she got to talk plenty, etc., but it seemed like from a strategic perspective, not the driving force that she was for the last month or so. And again, always happy to acknowledge that someone is probably going to be that kind of person when their team keeps going to tribal council over and over and over in a small group. So maybe it shouldn't be the most surprising thing in the world that now that there are 12 people left and crazy twists are falling from the sky, the likes of which have never been seen, that person suddenly receives substantially less focus. And it is entirely possible that me and many others over the last several weeks have perhaps been overstating the importance that Shan may end up having on this season overall, once she is not the person going to tribal council week after week after week. But yeah, still seems to be, at least through this first vote, in a pretty good spot, and obviously going to be one of the people that when she talks, I'm going to be listening over these next several weeks or however long she ends up staying in the game here, because I think it would, despite this kind of lower key Shan episode than we are used to, probably be a pretty big mistake, just given the spot that she is in within the game, to be writing Shan off here after one quiet week. But what are your Shan takes after this merge?
I think you covered the entire possible range of Shan takes there. I think in, not that she needs defending, but I think in her defense, we have just seen her play so much more Survivor than certainly anyone else on the season, but also most players in general who play a full season, that, yeah, some of that is not going to be perfect. And so it's easy to get hung up on that. And so, yeah, I think hyperbole not necessarily warranted at this stage, but I would say despite the botched vote this time around and also her closest ally really drawing attention to herself in botching that vote, she still seems to be in a fantastic spot where she's in the big majority, she's in the big alliance within the big majority, And then also within, even within that, at the very core of the onion, she has that bond with Liana that it seems like is unbreakable. So, still love Shan's position. And I think even if the table gets turned on that group, I think it depends a lot on who's doing it. If it's Ricard, then yeah, I think he might gun hard for Shan. If it's anyone else, I think you would more naturally go for like the Dannys and Deshawns of the world, right? Who are in that big Luvu group. Or Nasir is this kind of wild card who has an idol, and maybe we need to neutralize that before just to simplify the game. So even if things do get out of control, I think Shan probably can escape the hot seat for a bit, unless it's Ricard really driving that. So still in a good spot, still a lot of game left to be played, but we've seen Shan play so much game that it's easy to get hung up on some of the imperfections there.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And I'm sure we'll talk more about Shan along the way here, and probably in future episodes as well. But one of the most interesting dynamics that we saw emerge in this merge, sorry for the accidental pun there, normally I take full ownership of it, but that one was completely incidental there.
But also one of your best, so I would say own it completely.
Effortless, yes. The Shan and Liana bond was something that I was really interested in tracking once they had an opportunity to really start playing the game together now that they're on the same beach here, because one thing that stood out to me last week is when they hit the merge beach together, Shan has a confessional about how she feels amazing about Liana and she trusts her 100% and she's always going to have her back. And it really stood out to me that Shan in that confessional is still wearing a green buff. This is something that was clearly taken while they were separated still. They had had their time on Shipwheel Island together, but this is clearly time traveling, where this is something Shan said a while ago that is just now being put into the episodes. And it seems like that appears to be the case for Liana as well, which is a question that I had, because we had seen Shan knocking people on her own team off who thought they were her number one, one at a time, like an Agatha Christie novel, and not necessarily feeling airtight with Ricard entering this merge. But Liana was someone who, as far as I could tell, had a totally reliable fallback plan. And that, of course, being her Yasa group that it seemed like was pretty eager to keep working with her if she appeared willing to go for that. And this episode, at least the back half of this episode, largely focused on Liana, in my opinion, kind of choosing Shan over them and them getting the vibe that Liana may not be as solid as they had hoped, they meaning the Yasa people. And while we had heard in no uncertain terms from Evie pre-merge that their allegiance was going to be to the women of the Yasa tribe, and Xander was just kind of being strung along, and Evie furthermore this week has a tearful confessional where she's overcome with joy and gratitude once Xander presents to her the idea that he's gonna be using the idol as kind of a group idol if need be, when Evie probably by her own admission would not have done the same for Xander if the roles were reversed there. Liana seemingly pretty clearly choosing Shan over the people she'd spent the entire pre-merge portion of the game with, I thought was a pretty big deal, and probably something that will continue to be a major kind of theme of the show and factor, obviously, within the game itself for as long as the two of them are both out there. So let's get into this whole thing with Liana and the knowledge is power advantage and the ways in which the remaining Yasa people were trying to play around that here. So first of all, were you surprised to see Liana kind of make this hard break away from Yasa, because maybe I shouldn't have been, but I was.
I was not totally surprised. I think that that Yasa group coming to the merge is one of the most fascinating small groups of people that we've seen on the show in forever, where you take, I think, literally any combination of two of those people, and they have some subplot going on or something which makes the whole group dynamic a lot more complicated. So just within that four, you have the three women in theory sticking together, and that was like explicitly part of the motivation for Evie, at least. You then have within that Tiffany just kind of going rogue, spreading information back and forth between all of these different people. You have Evie and Liana have a certain relationship. Liana and Tiffany have a certain relationship. Evie and Tiffany have a certain relationship. And then Xander is just this weird variable that no one can quite make sense of, where Evie and Xander have this big sister, little brother thing, even though Evie would gladly have shanked Xander pre-merge or right now if it came down to it. You have Tiffany and Xander have this thing going on now too. And then the most strange thing about all of this is Liana and Xander. And I would love to know what the initial thing was that drove that wedge between them, because to me that is the key to understanding all of this. Where coming into this episode, there's a lot of discussion about Shan, of course, but I would say if Shan is number one in terms of positioning, Liana would have been number two. I think that it's not like when she makes this bold gamble, it's because she has no other options. She has so many options, maybe more than any other player aside from Shan. And I think if she could have straddled the fence for longer between the Yasa group and this new big group, she would have been in a fantastic spot. And I think that she, maybe more than most other people, got harmed by this twist, where if they are able to have this fairly quiet vote out of, I don't know, like a Ricard or an Erica even, or someone else, she can maybe remain hidden for a while longer. But when you have to vote out one of these five people, or now I guess it's one of these four people, once someone wins immunity, now some really tough choices have to be made, and you have to, you get exposed. But it seems like from the outset, there's always been this thing between Liana and Xander where even going back to the Voce boot, that was when it seemed like Liana was really going to assert herself against the others for the first time and insisting that it had to be Xander instead, and she didn't get her way there. So something before that must have poisoned that relationship from the outset. And then it was just a recurring theme of, we can't trust Xander, we've got to get Xander out. And so if that relationship was just untenable as she saw it, then that choice, that kind of middle ground, was kind of closed off, and this was the only move she felt like she could make.
Yeah, and I never would have thought that this would be the case so early after the merge, but I feel like we are now in a situation where we're down to, what, 11 people, most of whom, if not all of whom, I feel like are very eager to play an aggressive game and do whatever it takes to make it further, and very willing to work with pretty much whomever if the situation calls for it. And I might now be at the point where the only kind of relationship that I would consider more or less unsalvageable going forward, and watch this immediately just age as horribly as possible, and Liana gets back on board with the original yellow team like as soon as next week or whatever. But if I had to choose one group of people that would not be working together, or at least be highly skeptical of each other going forward, and this is something I never would have conceived of after the first few episodes, it really seems like the only one that would stand out to me along those lines is Liana getting back in the good graces of specifically Xander, Tiffany, and Evie after what I would consider a pretty hard turn on them at her first opportunity.
Well, even like Liana and Evie, let's say, I think both of them, if business required it, I think certainly Evie would be open to that again, or Liana might begrudgingly go along with it. But Lyanna and Xander, and specifically Lyanna towards Xander, there doesn't seem to be this mutual animosity. It seems to be almost entirely one way. And that's what makes me think, was there some, really bad interaction in the first few days where it was never, it was just going downhill from that point, right? Did she just get this really bad vibe from Xander? Did she think he was a certain type of person, perhaps? Like, I don't know. I think that Lyanna towards Xander, not even Xander towards Lyanna, I think is the most like off-limits relationship now. I don't think anything can piece that back together.
Yeah, and I mean, I did not think that Xander had much of a shot, if any, of getting truly into the good graces of Tiffany and Evie after hearing some of the things they were saying about him pre-merge. But it appears to me like that is a triforce of trust at this point, where I don't know what's going to become of them, and it does seem like their situation is precarious at the very least based on this first post-merge vote, and so maybe it's the case that they just get taken out and that's the end of that story. But I am shocked. One of the most surprising things to me of this merge episode is Xander, for my money, kind of taking the place of Lyanna in that trio that it seemed like Tiffany and Evie were working very hard to set up with Lyanna for like the duration of the pre-merge. But before we dive into all that goes on with Lyanna trying to take that idol away from her former tribe mates, zooming out a little bit, now that we have lost Sydney, how screwed do you think those former yellow team people are? Because based on the vote, it seems like things decidedly did not end up going their way here. They were the three people who put their votes on Deshaun. And yes, I did have to check the Wikipedia and write down who voted for whom, because I was not fully clear on it just having watched the episode. But
well, on that very quickly, I was looking at how those votes were split myself. Did it seem like to you it was that classic chestnut of, okay, well, we've got to divide it up somehow. So guys do this, girls do this. Because I think it actually did go that way, but that is pretty exploitable. And it felt like that opened the door here to like one vote going the wrong way ends up with Sydney going home, which I don't think anyone actually wanted, certainly from the large group. Versus, I mean, maybe, not even Erica, right? I think she seemed to be on board with going after Evie. Versus if they could have got it to a revote, I think Evie almost certainly goes there instead.
Yeah, I would agree that if they get it to a revote, Evie is gone. But I truly hadn't even noticed that it was Danny, Ricard, and the two Deshaun votes that went on to Evie. And then we have Nasir along with the women Shan, Lyanna, Erica, and Heather putting their votes on Sydney herself there. But my, I guess, first question would be, if Sydney were to have voted here, how would she fit into that? Because I don't know who she did feel good about, but if this was kind of a big group vote where they're splitting between two people, I wouldn't have thought that Sydney would have been one. I guess it's just process of who's vulnerable versus who's not, and that probably wouldn't be the case if there were more names on the table. But I guess I'm just curious about what people were saying to Sydney during the live tribal when so many of them are planning on putting votes on her and splitting with someone else as a backup plan.
Well, it seemed like when they split off into those two separate huddles, Cindy wasn't even in a huddle. She was like on the outskirts of the smaller Yasa huddle, just begging for table scraps of information.
Okay.
And so it seemed like she would have to vote for Deshaun, maybe just as like a desperation maneuver, even though the two of them are tight. Neither one of them wanted the other one to actually go home. But this is what the twist forces upon you. And this is why I'm maybe becoming a little bit more sympathetic to this twist. Not even for this episode, but maybe as a recurring feature of the game, it's that it brings people who ordinarily would not be in the spotlight and not have to worry about their position. Suddenly now they're in the hot seat. And so you saw with DeShawn kind of calling out Evie for spilling all the beans about Xander's advantages when they met up pre-merge. I don't think that happens here unless both Evie is vulnerable, which as she's in the minority, she would be, but also DeShawn is vulnerable because of this twist where not, I think otherwise he just comfortably rests on his laurels in the majority and keeps that avenue of communication open in case it becomes important.
Yeah, one of the benefits that goes hand in hand with this sort of thing where half of a large number of people are simply off the table to vote for could be similar to an idea we've tossed out a few times over the years where I think it would be cool if during at least the early phases of the post-merge game, whoever wins the individual immunity necklace not only gets immunity for themselves, and this is not at the same time as six other people are immune, but if there is just a true individual immunity challenge early post-merge, I think it would be a very cool wrinkle to, as usual, reference the genius here, throw in a token of life kind of element where the way the genius works is you play a main game at the beginning of the episode and one person is going to win that and they are immune from being chosen for the elimination game on the genius. And they also get to give what's called the token of life to someone else where they get to pick one person to also give immunity to. And I think that idea as well as this dynamic where a bunch of people are just off the table both go a long way in forcing people to kind of tip their hand or if not full-blown like show their cards earlier than they would ever otherwise have to. Like I think giving away one immunity necklace and essentially announcing you are the number one person that I want to keep safe when others may be thinking that they would be your number one person, or similarly forcing someone like Sydney, who probably would have skated by as the fifth or sixth or whatever in some alliance if this were a conventional vote, now becoming aware, and others like Sydney now becoming aware that like, oh, if push came to shove and other people were off the table, I'm at the bottom of this group. I think maximizing the opportunities for people to have to make that sort of thing clear much sooner than they ever otherwise would could be a very good thing for game dynamics going forward.
Yeah, returning to that hierarchy of who was in the best position, if Shanna and Liana were near the top, I think joining them in that like top tier or top tier but one would be Sydney, I think, because you know, she's in the Lubu group, but she seems to get along pretty well with the Yassas as well. I guess Erica has, you know, suspicions about her, but when she tried to act on those, there was this backlash from the other Lubus who kind of closed ranks behind Sydney. So I think Sydney was in a great spot. And as she so bitterly acknowledged, it took the initial twist of dividing the tribes, and then like she was immune initially, so that had to be reversed. And then she comes within seconds of winning the individual immunity, which would have bought her safety for the round. And then even after all of that, she needs Liana to botch the heist on Xander's idol. And after all of that, when it comes down to Evie versus Sydney, she needs the votes to like accidentally spill over onto her instead of Evie. So it's a whole mess. And it took these four or five separate things for Sydney to be the unlucky casualty of all of this, which I don't know if it's a good thing overall that someone's position can just dissolve that quickly, but as an occasional thing which needs all of these pieces to fit together, I think that's cool that something like that can happen.
Yes, absolutely. And we have wandered far now from the point that I was trying to set up when talking about the Shan and Liana bond, but let's get into Liana's attempt here at heisting this idol away from Xander using this knowledge is power advantage that she has. And big time credit to Shan for, albeit inadvertently, making this advantage way more interesting than I think it otherwise would have been if it had gone off like as intended and remained a secret. Because when the other people know that you have this and now can kind of plan around the prospect of you taking their idol from them, this does indeed become a very interesting kind of game theory problem here for the Yasa 3 of, okay, we know Liana has this advantage. It seems like she is going to want to use it tonight. So how do we get her to pick the wrong person on whom to play it? How do we get her to say, Xander, do you have an idol? When in reality, I've already given the idol to Tiffany ahead of time. And this was absolutely some very exciting stuff that would not have happened were it not for this advantage being in play in the first place. But I would also say it would not have happened if the advantage had gone off as intended by both the producers and the player who had it. It was simply, for my money, and sorry if this is overstating the degree of botching it here from Shan, but I feel like Shan kind of spewing this made this as interesting as it was. So let's get into, from the Yasa 3 perspective, the way that they went about this, because I have talked many times over the years about on Survivor, and particularly as things pertain to people wearing idols around their neck at tribal council or idol related kind of shenanigans, it is a strongly recurring theme that weak means strong and strong means weak. And as I was watching this, you know, before we even got the flashback of, oh, actually Xander's thing that he had in his pants was a fake and Tiffany had this the whole time and this was all an elaborate ruse, just seeing Xander so eager to tell the whole group at tribal council that he had the idol on him and was going to play it for Evie or whatever the situation was, it came across to me like they were really trying to bait her into using it on him that night. But obviously that is much easier said from my position than being in Liana's position here. So what did you think about the way that they went about this?
So I think it's worth noting that all of this can only really happen because Xander himself was safe. And also maybe because Tiffany herself was safe too, where it has got to be so tempting to either use the idol on yourself or to, in Tiffany's case, like once you have the idol, to play it on yourself if you think you could be a part of the split vote. But the fact that Evie is vulnerable, but the other two are safe, that is what allows them to kind of go out on a limb and be passing the idol back and forth and bluffing and so on, because they don't have to worry about their own hides here. And that, I think, is the contribution that this twist is making, where I unless it's like Xander wins the individual immunity too and now has a lot of room to play, other than that, you don't get this interesting choice being set up. But I did actually think, so what one scene that I haven't really seen talked about at all in all of the analysis of this is when Xander and Danny are having their little conversation, kind of feeling each other out in the shelter. Xander tells Danny that he knows Liana has the seal of vote advantage, which I think was intended to sow some suspicion about Liana among this bigger group. I don't know, like, I don't think Xander is aware of the Black Alliance or the larger kind of workings of what's going on there. But it seemed like the effect of that was Danny now knows that Xander knows. And so Danny goes back to Liana, and now Liana knows that Xander knows, which means that, you know, working backwards, Tiffany must have blown up Liana's spot. And so not only has Tiffany kind of betrayed you and betrayed your trust, but now that entire alliance knows you're planning to flip on them. And in theory, that should affect your prediction of what they're going to do with this shared idol, however shared it may be. So that, did that seem like a big misstep from Xander to you? Because if Xander just doesn't say that, if he says to Danny, hey, look, we both know I have this idol. Evie helped me find it. And so I'm going to use it on Evie. I want to honor that. But doesn't give away that he knows what the bigger picture is, then like Danny goes back to Liana, says, okay, well, it seems like all's going according to plan, and Liana doesn't get tipped off that maybe there's another possibility here.
Yeah, so I wasn't sure and did not bother to look up the answer to this, so maybe you can help me. Did Danny already know that Liana had that? Because the reason is, in trying to kind of reverse engineer why Xander would say that, and I think this is pretty consistent with a lot of what we saw out of Xander pre-merge, and is frankly something that I feel like is going to become more and more common as Survivor players, for my money, get better and better at Survivor, is I feel like we've seen a lot from Xander about wanting to be, like, aggressively honest with people, even in spots that what he's saying to them may not be what they want to hear necessarily. And this is something I definitely remember talking a lot about as things pertain to, like, Adam Klein in Millennials versus Gen X, talking about, like, this is the future of, like, game theory Survivor, is people being straightforward. And I think the reason for that in this case is Xander trying to communicate to Danny, hey, my cards are on the table with you. I'm telling you everything I know about, and if Liana hasn't already told you about this, maybe you should have some questions about Liana, not about me. I'm the one looping you in here. And so that was the way that I chalked this up as kind of being Xander's motivation, is wanting Danny to feel like, of course I can trust Xander because he's willing to tell me even things that I don't want to hear or wouldn't theoretically be in his best interest to tell me here. I think there is, and will continue to think there is, a lot to taking that sort of line, but it definitely does change a bit if, like, Danny already knows about that from Liana, or if Xander knows that Danny knows about it. There's a lot of leveling going on here, but that is how I assigned that kind of motivation, is Xander continuing, as we saw a few times pre-merge, with wanting to be as straightforward, almost to the point of being a fault, straightforward with people to build up their faith in him.
Yeah, and so I'm not saying it's like an outright mistake from Xander, but the way that it played out, it meant that if Liana was being, like, attentive to that clue, well, now there's a whole new universe of possibilities that she has to consider. Whereas if she thinks that she successfully bamboozled all of them and that Tiffany is still thinking that Liana's with them too, then it becomes much more straightforward for her to just say, all right, we're going to spring this on Xander at Tribal Council, and it's all going to go according to plan. When in practice, that is like the first warning sign that we saw, at least, that, okay, you actually need to think through the other options here, because by the time we get to Tribal and, like, everyone knows that everyone knows everything else, some amount of the time Xander should still have his idol, right? But then, even if you think he maybe did give it away, well, then did he give it to Evie? Did he give it to Tiffany? Tiffany is like the Edgardo in this situation.
Yes, exactly.
Right? She is the artist with the Pete and Abby of it all. And so having that third person take the idol, I think, is a smart move, but it's also so hard to suss out where if Liana says, oi, Tiffany, give me that idol, she looks like a genius. But if she says that and it's the, I don't know, 65% of the time that Tiffany doesn't have it, well, people would be saying exactly the same things that they are saying about her now. So
one thing that stood out to me is, and maybe I'm missing something here, and it's certainly possible that I'm kind of getting lost in the who knows what and kind of leveling war of it all, but there is a scene where Liana approaches Shan with her knowledge is power clue and says, I just want to read this over and have someone else take a look at this to make sure that I fully understand how to do this and what to say and whom to be playing it on. And as Shan is kind of just reading it aloud, and I'm sorry, I don't remember if this is before or after word got back to Danny that Xander was, like, anticipating all of this, but right away when Shan is, before Shan is even done reading aloud, the words on the page to Liana, Liana interjects and says, well, what if they just give it to someone else? Because they know, because you said this in front of Tiffany, that I have this. Right away, it seems like Liana is hip to the idea that they could just put it in someone else's possession, whether or not Xander has said anything to Danny at that point, or if that has gotten back to Liana. I feel like this is something, point being, that Liana easily could have, if not actively did, anticipate before anything that went down with Danny.
I wonder how much of that is just due diligence, considering the obvious options, giving your opponents the credit that they deserve, versus, oh, it's Xander. He's so wily. He's going to have some diabolical scheme that we have to play around, right? But yeah, either way, if Liana's play here was being kind of controlled or mediated through Shan, then maybe that's where this error creeps into it. And we saw this disagreement between the two of them where Shan was like, oh, would Evie really do that? And Liana was like, yeah, Evie is super smart. She's going to be considering all these options. But then it was like before that, there was another Liana scene where it almost seemed like she was diminishing the ability of the other Yassas to like think for themselves and come up with some weird play. So yeah, lots to kind of sink your teeth into there. A few things that also stood out to me about this vote. So first of all, we see Deshaun become the choice for the Yassas as here's the person we're going to stick our votes on. We don't know how the other discussions went, but it seemed like Danny's name, it was so easy to forget that he also was vulnerable, and this is part of why he was so upset, right? Is he wins immunity and now can receive votes of tribal council, which is not something that should ever happen, but he doesn't receive votes, and it seems like no one really entertained the idea of having Danny receive votes. So despite being the prototypical merge boot, right? He's the most overtly athletic guy in the big alliance. It seems like his name was never even in the discussion. And then there's also Nasir, who in theory is a good like fallback option and doesn't have strong ties with anybody really, and also has an idol, but it seemed to be taken as given that, oh, with all of this chaos going on, Nasir will use his idol, and so right. Why even fall prey to that? Instead, we're just going to pretend that doesn't exist and then move on with our lives. But the upshot is Nasir kind of sniffs this out, doesn't play his idol, and now he has an idol going into this next stretch of the game too.
Right, yeah. Nasir, I feel like we didn't see, first of all, anything either from or about Nasir here, and I am chalking that up to, as you suggested, people just being nervous that Nasir may just err on the side of caution, not want to be the merge boot, play his idol if he's even slightly nervous. And that, I think, is totally justifiable on behalf of anyone trying to come up with a vote target here. Obviously happy to see Nasir survive and keep his idol, but I would be completely blown away to such an extent that, like, I think it's more or less impossible that no one was ever floating Nasir's name out there. I'm positive, essentially, that all six of the, or I guess all five of the names that were in the mix to receive votes that night had many people talking about at least the possibility of going that route at one point or another, and eventually it all just kind of settled on these three. And then as for the Danny also never having his name on the TV episodes in the mix as someone to be voting out because it's a surprise given his kind of prototypical merge boot status, I think it is taken for granted by most of the people in the game that Danny and the Deshaun, at least as things stand now, are kind of a package deal, and neither of them has an idol at this point, and these are smart players for the most part, if not all of them, who I think are very capable of moving beyond the level one thought of Danny's a big physical threat and he's vulnerable tonight and he doesn't have an idol, so let's vote him out. I think if you are choosing which one of Danny or Deshaun to put your votes on, if you want to go for one of the two of them, in the year 2021, I think Deshaun's kind of a no-brainer there. I'm not worried about Danny winning the game. He might win a necklace or two somewhere, or maybe more than that, and he might find an idol somewhere down the line. But if I were one of the players out there in the game, I would be far more nervous about Deshaun being a long-term threat.
Yeah, and he seems like just a very solid, very capable player based on everything we've seen. So, yeah, maybe he's the real threat there, to be sure.
Deshaun, I don't think I stated this in adequately hyperbolic terms earlier. Deshaun's ability to smile and give the reaction that the producers wanted to the news about that immunity switcheroo there is frankly, like, for a person like me, completely mind-blowing. And he's not the only one who handled it gracefully or whatever, but Deshaun organically reacting in that way to such devastatingly bad news is one of the most impressive things I've seen out of anyone this season, and is something that we have certainly talked about over the years as things pertain to, like, Sari or to, like, Sandra. The idea of just always being in on the joke and handling it well. For maybe Sandra's not the perfect example of that, but, like, I thought Deshaun remarkably impressive in handling that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure some of that is just a learned response to whatever bullshit he's had to deal with in real life as well. But yeah, very just impressive poise while all of this nonsense was going on around him. I wonder if, hypothetically, let's flip the script here. Erica either doesn't break the hourglass or doesn't have the chance to, and that initial group, the other five, I guess, including Erica herself, end up going to that tribal council in the hot seat. Who do you think goes home there? How does that vote play out?
I think many people would have a vested interest in seeing someone from the original blue team go home, just to be on the safe side and shut the door on the prospect of being down to a final 11 where six of them all started on the same tribe and at least in challenges were a cohesive unit. So I think Erica could certainly draw some heat for that reason. And furthermore, we've certainly heard plenty from Danny about really wanting a woman to be eliminated at some point soon so that the men are not just, like, grossly outnumbered the rest of the way forward. So I'm certainly not saying this with any real degree of confidence, but I think, gun to my head, I would feel like Erica was probably on the hot seat there more so than most others.
Interesting. You don't think it would have turned into just split the votes between Xander and Tiffany or something?
It certainly could have. I have a hard time even speculating about this just because we didn't get to see any sort of conversation when the people thought that these six are immune and the others are the ones who are going to be vulnerable. And I may just be in my own head here 100%, but it seemed like most of the people on her original tribe were not too stoked on the idea of working with Erica long term, and I don't necessarily know if this fallout is identical if the others are the ones who are vulnerable as far as the Xander, Tiffany, and Evie kind of being clearly on the outs goes, and maybe it is, but gun to my head, I feel Erica, for whatever reason, is the name that pops out to me, but again, this is pretty much based on nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Great analysis there, me. So, yeah. Dom, as we look forward now to this final 11, it certainly seems, based on this last vote, like the original Yasa people, that trio minus Liana, are currently on the hot seat. But because of Xander somehow, like, soul reading the group that Evie was not going to have enough votes on her to necessitate the use of an idol that night, they still have that hidden immunity idol, and everyone else knows about that. Do you feel like what odds would you place, I guess, on one of the three of Xander, Tiffany, and Evie going next versus the field? Because to me, for whatever reason, I feel like that is at best maybe 50-50. I'm basing this on very little, but I feel like we're going to get someone other than one of those three out next for some unforeseeable reason.
Yeah, especially if Ricard and or Erica are looking to mix it up, this might be the perfect chance to do it, is if the natural move is split the votes between the minority alliance members who have an idol, and that's the great time to either, I guess maybe you have it all. You get to flush the idol and also flip over and vote someone out at the same time.
Yeah, so could certainly come in here next week, and it's a, I guess, air quotes, straightforward kind of boot of one of those original Yasa. But I feel like, and sorry for the mini edit zone here, I feel like we're just not done with the three of them yet. So,
should we get into the actual edit zone here?
Momentarily. I have one final question for you, before the edit zone, which is, Dominic, am I miscounting the number of people left here? I know Sydney is not on the jury. Aren't there only 11, or are we doing an 8-person jury and a final three? Or are we going to a 9-person jury and a final two? What's going on here?
I don't know how the final two would work with the beloved fire-making twist. I guess that still could work, right? Like, let's say we get down to three, and then someone wins immunity, but they don't get to take someone with them. Instead, we have a fire-making challenge to decide who that second person is going to be, and I'm retching a little bit even thinking about it here.
Imagine the bait and switch when Jeff says, great news, guys, no more final four fire-making challenge, and then it turns out it's just the final three instead.
Yeah, let me see. So 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Yeah, I think it's 11 people here. So we're going to have to square that circle somehow. But we've seen them do, famously, was it Micronesia that had? No, that was final two. Okay,
yeah, it was Micronesia had an 8-person jury in a final two because Eric Reichenbach voted for Amanda, allegedly, because he just wanted to see what would happen if there was a tie.
Yeah, so I feel like we've had a final three with 8 people before, and which would seem to kind of defeat the point of it a little bit, but maybe we get like a Ghost Island reboot kind of situation here.
Well, the problem is there's then no... If it is... Okay, I'm confusing now Micronesia and a final three with 8 votes. I don't know that you can do at this point, or what they would have done in Micronesia if there had indeed been a tie and not been a Laurel figure 0-vote finalist who could then break that tie. But I guess we're not going to have to probably deal with that under any of the circumstances here. Dom, in looking at these 11 people remaining, I feel very bad saying this because I don't think it's her fault at all, frankly. But if I had my druthers here, I think if I could just hand pick who the next person to be eliminated would be, I would have to say just Heather by default, just because I feel like we've gotten to see at least some, if not a ton, from everyone else in the game, and I'm really excited and don't want to lose any of the other people that we've had in the game here. But I feel bad saying that because, I don't think this is Heather's fault by any stretch. It's just the way the chips have fallen for her.
Well, good news, Colin. That's the next twist. You have the chance to change the course of Survivor history. You have the sole discretion over who goes home. So you use that power responsibly.
Okay. More on Heather. We got some Heather news in the edit zone as well. Dom, anything else from you before we get there?
No, let's get into it.
All right. Well, that is going to do it for the main portion. I'm going to focus a little more now on the editing side of it all. I know not necessarily everyone's bag, so if that isn't your thing, now would be the time to tune out. Looking forward to seeing what happens and coming back in here next week. Tentatively looking forward to seeing what happens next week, TBD, I suppose. But I think now, Dom, without any further ado, let's dive in to the edit zone. Okay, edit zone bumper goes here. Here we go. All right, Dom, here we are in the edit zone. I just kind of teased the fact that we have some Heather news in the edit zone. Not the conventional place to start, I would imagine, with most editing kind of discussion here, but did want to get it on the record. I'm not sure who is tracking this or what the metric even is, but I was sent a chart, and in the year 2021, a chart you see on the internet is nothing if not gospel and conclusively true, apparently, according to people who track confessionals or screen time or whatever more closely than I do. I'm much more of a feel player than a math player when it comes to the edit. Dom, Heather has now broken the all-time record and is the number one most invisible contestant in the 41 season history of Survivor. The 600 plus players who have played this game, none have been less visible on the TV episodes than Heather to this point. Obviously there is time for that to change, but congratulations, Heather, number one most invisible contestant in the history of the show. How does this happen in the year in 2021 when it seems like so many of the editing changes have been very positive?
I'm waiting for her breakout downfall episode, but she's going to vault up like 100 places just on the strength of that alone. But that chart made for fascinating reading, because you look at just the season breakdown of that, and so many of them were in the 20s in what has been associated with like that dark era of Survivor, but specifically South Pacific really punching above its weight, more so than any other season, where I think at least three or four people in that top 20, top 25, whatever it was, all from that season alone.
It was Rick, Keith, Whitney, and someone else who I am very aptly forgetting about. We're all in the top. Elise, yes, we're all
so,
in.
So invisible that even among that cohort, you know, you can't remember her name.
Yes. So along kind of Heather lines, my main edit takeaway this week, and I was very annoyingly kind of tweeting vaguely about this sort of thing because I desperately did not want this to be the case and am deeply nervous, deeply, deeply nervous that it will continue being the case for not just this season, but many future seasons for as long as people continue to be taken out in objectively just like bullshit ways. Is for my money, and I think this could happen to Heather down the line, but in this case, it was Sydney. I felt like on the heels of a twist this egregious, they were never going to let specifically a first-time player. I could see it changing a bit with returnees, but in the world of one-time players, someone who leaves under such gross circumstances be anyone that was like an audience favorite or potentially even like remotely likable to the audience. This entire episode, I thought it was essentially a foregone conclusion, and I have not felt that way at any point in any previous episodes of this season, that the boot was either going to be Sydney or Danny. And when we saw literally zero words about the idea of eliminating Danny, I was at that tribal council up until the point where Sydney said she had an advantage to play, which just about gave me a heart attack because I was so certain that it just had to be Sydney, because she was getting what I would consider like the future bullshit twist victim edit, where when someone is going to leave under these kind of circumstances, we have to make that as palatable as possible for the audience. And so to me, even though there was all this craziness going on and probably more variables in play than we've seen certainly at any point this season, at no point in this episode did I feel like virtually anyone other than Sydney was even drawing live to be eliminated, because of the idea that they do not want these kind of twists to make the audience mad. They want the audience to be happy with the outcome of who the victim of these twists are, and that will kind of let the bullshit element of it all be swept under the rug.
Yeah, it turns out that Sydney was the current bullshit twist victim, but many more of those to come. And
that's what I'm wondering about Heather, and you actually brought this up. Like, Heather, I didn't know she was the literal number one most invisible person in the history of the show, but the reason that chart was brought to our attention is I asked in a group chat, has anyone ever had less, or I guess fewer, confessionals than Heather as an active contestant at this point through seven episodes, and I was sent that chart of the most invisible contestants of all time, and I am getting past the point where I can convince myself, oh, she's probably not the most exciting person on this, compared to the rest, on this tribe that has literally never had to go to a vote. I am now getting deeply nervous for on Heather's behalf about why she is getting absolutely nothing. It would be so easy to give her some like throwaway confessionals after you come back from a challenge, just explain something that could be going to anyone and is generally going to Shan or Evie or whatever. I feel like it would take very little effort to give Heather some sort of cursory anything to make her more of a TV presence. And the fact that she is getting actively put onto the back burner week after week after week after week makes me incredibly nervous about what is going to happen to Heather at some point in this game.
Yeah, I think at this point, there is close to zero chance that Heather has a conventional exit. And we might not see the details of that necessarily, but either it's going to be some game-shattering twist, and we already have the details of one of those for the people who want to go looking for that. I would pencil her in as a potential victim of that for sure, or if there's some like big controversy, I don't think we're going to see Heather like expelled from the game or something necessarily. But, you know, if there is some weird controversial exit, which really soured the producers on her, then maybe this is that, or some other twist whose existence we don't even know about yet. Either way, it's going to be something in that vein for sure, I would argue, and not just, oh, well, we're going from Final 8 to Final 7 and there's no obvious person to vote out, so our alliance just picks off Heather. It feels like it has to be on some larger scale at this point.
Right. I had casual Anna in here last week. Incidentally, it was like casual Anna week on the podcast. They also brought her on to the challenge episode for anyone who missed that and likes the challenge. That was a lot of fun. And when I asked her about the various people in the cast, my question about Heather was, do you know who Heather is? And casual Anna said, are you trying to trick me, or is there actually someone named Heather on this season? And that seems like a pretty bad sign. I am deeply nervous that Heather is going to, as you said, be eliminated in some wildly unconventional way, and they just want to make sure that the overwhelmingly casual fan base is not upset by that. So we'll see what becomes of Heather, but did want to note for the record, at least as things stand right now, literally the single least visible contestant in the history of Survivor, which is just wild to me. But let's switch it over, Dom, from the least visible to the runaway most visible. Up until this week, we've talked a bit about Shan already, obviously, and I was trying to kind of dance around this before we were in the edit zone, but Shan's lack of visibility this week, I actually thought could at least conceivably be kind of a good thing for her, considering how responsible she was, in my view, for all of this kind of falling on Liana, and Liana looking pretty bad along the way here in not executing this advantage to its fullest potential, to say the very least. Or I think Shan kind of spilling the beans had a lot to do with that. And I think my leading theory at this point, while I have come down at least a bit on the prospect of Shan just being like the overwhelming number one, the way that I did in previous weeks, I think it could at least be argued that like Shan being invisible and not being as linked to this knowledge is power thing going haywire as was necessarily deserving for her could be a very good thing, that they are trying to bury the misplays from Shan in certain spots.
Yeah, I think if there's a bad episode to take off from an editing standpoint, then the merge episode is it, usually. And I think, I'm trying to remember who this came up in relation to. I think it was Natalie Anderson on San Juan del Sur, where she had like a very quiet merge episode, and that threw a lot of people off the scent there. But typically, the merge episode is, it's a big episode in the season. That's where you're meant to make yourself known if you haven't already. in Tran's case, she has made herself known, more than known. She has been the most visible character on the season, basically, other than, I guess, one of relative or absolute terms, like JD may have had more confessionals at certain points and so on, but of the characters who are still there, we know the most about Shan and we're meant to know the most about Shan. And so given that, I think it's fine to take an episode or two off, especially when, as you say, it seems like she may be kind of faltering a little bit. And then if she is back on form, back in front of our eyes on our screens in a week or two, then I'm not going to be distracted from her chances there.
Really. Right, right. And I think for, unfortunately, this season, next season, and quite conceivably many, many seasons to come, as we anticipated and were concerned about, like, in our season preview podcast and in some of the patron episodes that we did many, many months ago before we'd even met any of these people or seen them on TV for the very first time, combining both the long hiatus that Survivor had and their desire for this after such a big break and all the horrible shit that's been going on in the world lately to probably more so than ever be feel good TV. We were already very nervous about the prospect of a just beat you over the head with a winner at it and make sure that every casual in the world knows this is the person you should be liking, this is the person you should know a lot about and be rooting for and be happy on finale night when they end up winning. When we combine that element with the seemingly large number of ridiculous twists along the way, I think it is going to be a high, high priority, kind of like the opposite of the future bullshit twist victim edit is the overwhelming winner edit where when the season is all said and done, as long as the casual fan base, which makes up an overwhelming percentage of the people watching this show, are happy about the outcome, then they are willing to let go of a lot more things than if they are unhappy about the outcome. And I still feel like along those lines, Shan is still my pretty clear front runner, even though it was a quieter week than usual for her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although would say again, come down slightly on Shan's overall winning chances this week and probably bumping up Deshaun quite a bit. I feel like
you're only at like 70% instead exactly. of 85% or something.
Right. Yes. I feel like Deshaun has gained some ground over the Nasirs of the world. Evie making a push up for me as well. Xander probably deserves to be in the mix with some sort of equity here, but I think we are squarely looking at people the audience is obviously meant to be liking and rooting for, and anyone else is just completely drawing dead. So good week, very good week for Deshaun for my money. Very good to have Evie firmly back in the mix after a couple of quieter weeks there. And then what do you think, if anything, about a theory I feel like I hear tossed around pretty regularly these days? Dom, is Tiffany a winner candidate in your mind?
It would seem like such a weird start for a winner to get off to. I don't know if you can move past those initial perceptions, really. And I think she may end up as that kind of a quintessential fourth placer, the person who gets off to a really rough start, has this big transformation, and ends up flourishing by the end of the season, but just falls a little bit short of getting to that that final hurdle.
Right. The reason, cards on the table now, that I feel like the three Yasas may not be totally done yet, as far as like one of them being the next one eliminated, is I just get the sense that they're being set up to be bigger, kind of deeper run characters, and I could obviously be dead wrong about that, but Tiffany in my mind, and this could be an all-time case of me just reading way, way, way too much into one little thing, But I feel like Tiffany is lock safe until we get some sort of resolution on something that literally may not be anything. But I remember noticing it and putting it on the record in whatever episode it was in that week's edit zone, where when she has that interaction pre-merge with Xander, where he lies to her about when he found the idol, she gets it unnecessarily subtitled when she says to him, "Oh, I can spot a lie from a mile away. I am very much waiting for that to pay off in some way," where someone lies to Tiffany and she does not spot it. Until there's some big resolution on that, I feel like Tiffany is pretty safe. And I just really don't know that I can see either of Evie or Xander leaving literally in the next vote. Although the more I think about it, like, there are still plenty of people that I feel like have very good deep run possibilities as far as their story is concerned, and they obviously can't all make it there. So very ready to be dead wrong about all of that, but I still feel like there's going to be some payoff for Tiffany with the "I can spot a lie from a mile away" getting subtitled. But hopefully that's just me reading way too much into some random thing. Either way, Dom, how's Liana looking at this point for you?
Not good.
Yeah, Liana, in one of the pre-merge episodes, and sorry to just keep referencing our old edit zones along the way here, I definitely remember feeling like, and I think saying, the dunnest dun chain might be on Liana. Even though she's gotten plenty of visibility, it felt like when they had the opportunity to make any of Evie, Xander, Tiffany, Liana look really good and look like the most rootable person on that tribe and like the voice of what's going on, it was pretty much always Evie in situations where it easily could have been Liana, and they just chose not to do that. And so I continue to think that Liana is probably going to play a crucial role in the game, but I still have a hard time seeing her win there. Unfortunately, I hate to say this, but I feel like we would have seen something from Nasir this week if he were the eventual winner, just based on how little other opportunity there had been to get Nasir kind of in the mix. But still feeling like he's going to be in there for a little while, and certainly rooting very hard for Nasir. Any other notable edit developments this week from you?
Nothing else for me, no.
Okay, I think that is plenty as we hit right around the 2-hour mark now here on this. But Dom, great times. Glad that we were able to get in here and talk about all of this. And again, hopefully going to be back next week, unless it's just like a complete and utter catastrophe. But still want to be clear, very much enjoying the season overall. I am just... I continue to be deeply nervous about the production bad decision making that could turn this otherwise incredible, like historically good cast into a season that becomes far less interesting than it probably should have been. But let's not dwell too much on the negative for any longer. Dom, I believe that is going to do it for us here this week. He is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. We will talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.